You're listening to a panel from the Resilience of Racism Conference, held June 1st through the 3rd, 2017, at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center. This conference was hosted by the Equal Justice Society and made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the California Endowment, the law firm of Morgan Lewis, the Sierra Health Foundation, and the San Francisco Human Rights Commission. For more information, visit us on the web, equaljusticesociety.org/mindscience.
And so I have with us today four panelists. Dr. Jack Glasser is a professor with the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. His primary research interests are in stereotyping, prejudice, and discrimination. Next to him, we have Professor Armstrong, is an associate professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. Some of her research focus is in fair housing, privilege studies, and constitutional law. We next have Professor Aaron Carrison, is an assistant professor of social welfare at the University of California, Berkeley, and her work focuses on structural disadvantage and state supervision on service delivery, substance abuse, comorbidity, violence, and a couple of other issues. And lastly, we have Professor Linda Green, who's a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her teaching and scholarship focuses in the areas of con law, constitutional law, civil procedure, legislation, and civil rights. So we're going to kind of forego some of the more broader introductions to the work that they're specifically doing, and we're going to jump right into the presentations that they've prepared for this panel on the epidemic of police shootings. So if you would, welcome these guests, and we're going to start with Jack.
Thank you. Good morning. It's still morning. Good morning. Let me just say a little bit about myself and my background and how it's relevant to what I'm going to talk about. My training as a scientist was primarily in the area of implicit bias and this, and we're talking about in the early to mid-1990s when it was a fairly new concept. And you know, I could say that my mind was forged in the crucible of the Banaji lab, and we were talking about some of the very fundamental issues. But around 1999, my emphasis shifted toward policing. And this was a fairly graceful shift for me because it was clear at the time and is clearer now that what we know about how bias, racial bias, gender bias, other forms of bias operate is highly relevant to policing. And that, in fact, a lot of what we see in the racial disparities in policing is driven by stereotypes. Now, having said all of that, I want to acknowledge that this is kind of a jarring transition here to go from the more general issues around bias in the criminal justice system to this particular topic of shootings. And that's okay, because the topic of shootings, of police shootings of civilians is an important one for a couple of reasons. And on the one hand, I don't want us to get distracted by it because in a way it's really just the tip of the iceberg, or if you can tolerate two metaphors at the same time, the canary in the coal mine. And so in the tip of the iceberg sense, the police shootings are really what we can see. They're the observable part of the problem. But the problem is much bigger, and it lies underneath the surface, and it's much harder for most people to detect. And what we're getting now is not only statistical evidence, but video evidence of a very potent problem that is plaguing our society. But again, the racial disproportions that I'm going to show you some data on in police shootings is in parallel with disparities that we're seeing in more mundane policing, including stop, question, and frisk, and decisions about use of non-lethal force and decisions to arrest, et cetera. So it's an important transition, and it's an important topic, and it's the topic of conversation in the nation right now, so we have to talk about shootings, and every death is tragic and significant. But I think we want to bear in mind that it reflects a much larger problem, and it enables us to have some insight into that problem. I'll also say that with regard to shootings, with regard to the use of lethal force in general, implicit bias actually plays a particularly special role. While I believe and I have data that supports the notion that implicit bias affects lots of decision-making, both in policing and in other industries. In the case of the decision to make to use lethal force, I believe implicit bias is particularly influential. And I say that because while I think implicit bias is very important in a lot of domains, I also want us to be cautious about overestimation of the importance of implicit bias. But by virtue of its very nature, if we could wipe everybody's brains clean today of implicit bias, whatever, however you want to define that, of associations between particular groups and particular traits or preferences, if we could wipe everybody's brains clean today, tomorrow, all of those implicit biases would be back. Because we live in a society that is structured and conveys that information on a moment-to-moment basis. And so, as other people have said, this is that we have both structural problems and we have cognitive problems, but the implicit bias part is actually very much normal human cognition, and we're not going to be able to cure it. And I was very much appreciative of Judge Donald's emphasis on the role of discretion in these decision-making processes. But again, when it comes down to lethal force, there is a much greater limitation on the discretion that an individual officer has once they've gotten themselves to that point where they have to decide whether or not to use, in that millisecond where they have to decide whether or not to use lethal force. And so implicit bias looms particularly large in that set of decisions. Different audiences are more or less receptive to the following statistics, but in terms of having a good grounding in the notion that there really are racial disparities in police officers' decisions about use of force, one of the most compelling pieces of evidence comes from this task force in New York State that was brought about in the wake of a couple of fatal shootings of off-duty police officers, Omar Edwards, you may have heard of, Christopher Ridley. And in the wake of that, the governor commissioned this task force to look into this issue of off-duty officers being fatally shot by on-duty officers. And my students and I dug down and we made a conservative estimate that over the period studied from 1981 to 2009, at most 25% of police officers were non-white, of sworn officers were non-white at that time. So roughly 75% of the force, and probably more over this time period, are white. But among those who were off-duty officers who were fatally shot by on-duty officers, only one out of the 10 cases that were identified by this group was white, and 8 were African-American, and 1 was Latino. Now, these are small numbers, and good statisticians will tell you to be cautious with small numbers, but these are the numbers. This is the population of fatal shootings of off-duty police officers. And the likelihood that you would get that result by chance, given that this is the distribution of race in sworn officers in the U.S., is well under 1 in 1,000,000. We ran the calculation. So this is an unlikely event to occur by chance. There may be other things that explain it in addition, but it's a pretty dramatic illustration. And you can imagine that, and we know from all of these cases that none of these officers were engaged in an actual crime at the time that they were fatally shot, and they were not posing a threat to the officers who shot them. Now, because of the public attention that's come to this issue, we have some better data. And in particular, we have data from the Washington Post, which has been tracking fatal shootings since the beginning of 2015. And what they've been able to identify, and again, these data are incomplete, but the first thing that we note from those data are that if we compare what they've identified through both police reports and media reports and some crowdsourcing, that we were undercounting, at least police were undercounting the number of fatal shootings in the United States by about a factor of 2. And so whereas it was estimated at being in the area of 500 a year, it's really more in the area of 1,000 a year. And this is just fatal shootings. This is not other fatal use of force. But what the data show us is that while whites who are fatal victims of police shootings or were in 2015, and the data are pretty stable across 2016 and into 2017 at this point, whites are the most common victim of fatal shootings of police. That's especially true when they are armed with a deadly weapon. But among those who are unarmed at the time that they're shot, they are not only disproportionately black, but they are even numerically more black, which is striking given the racial distribution in the country. Another way of looking at these same data would be to say, among those who are fatally shot by the police, what percent are unarmed or were unarmed? And you can see that for whites, it's about half what it is for other groups. So whites need to, they're more likely to be in possession of a lethal weapon when shot by the police, which probably indicates something that we know from a lot of policing data, is that whites have a higher burden of proof when it comes to presenting themselves as suspicious or threatening in some way. And none of this should come as a surprise to social psychologists or cognitive psychologists, because we've understood, now I'm going to have a mysterious slide, we've understood for a long time that people have a lot of biases and heuristics in their decision making, and that they make decisions based on incomplete information. Oh, that was not supposed to happen. This isn't an experiment. Maybe that is on me. The reason I'm showing this image is because this is one of the hundreds and hundreds of psychological experiments that illustrates very powerfully that we see things that aren't there. So for example, you probably see one or two triangles. If you're a member of the tribe like me, you may see a Star of David. And you may even see that the inner part of the triangle looks lighter than the outer part of the triangle. You may even see a barrier there. That's not there. It's an optical illusion. And that's because our brains are wired to see things even when we don't have the complete information about them. That's adaptive. That helps us navigate our physical and social environments. But it's true of how we perceive people as well. And so, generally speaking, cognitive psychology has taught us that we perceive things schematically. We have prior networks of memories, and we plug the things that we see into them. And part of those networks are just built over time through memory and learning. But we do that very automatically, very spontaneously, very rapidly, and without our awareness. And this is true for social cognition as well. Our perceptions of other people is also done very automatically and in a very schematic sort of way. And stereotypes in particular are just social schemas about groups of people. And then the other important point to note, and this is, I think, something that gets lost in this discussion often, is that most of our cognition occurs implicitly and automatically. Most of the processing, the encoding of information, the perception of information, the storage of information, and the retrieval of information, and then the application of that information, most of that occurs without our conscious awareness and control. And it has to be that way. If it weren't that way, we would be paralyzed by our environments. And so we've evolved to do that. But when it comes down to making judgments and acting toward other people, and doing so in a discriminatory manner because of a prior conception about the group they belong to, it becomes deeply problematic. So we don't want to confuse normal with desirable or acceptable. Oh, that just gave away the ghost because I clicked too hard. So one experiment that I like to talk about in order to illustrate this is the wonderful work by Jennifer Eberhard and Phil Goff and Valerie Purdy Vaughn and Paul Davies. And in this research, this particular set of studies is kind of a microcosm for this whole issue. And it brings us all the way from the cognitive psychology that was developed in the 1960s and 70s up to the present day public national crisis that we're in with regard to biased policing and particularly lethal force. In this experiment, people are shown a set of images like this, and they're asked to disambiguate this image and say what they think it is. Is it a crime-related object or a not crime-related object? And they're shown 41 frames of this image, and it becomes depixelated. This is just my way of illustrating it with three frames, but it becomes depixelated over time. And they're just asked to identify it as a crime-related object as fast as they can. Unbeknownst to the people in the experiment, they're either being subliminally exposed to a black person's face or a white person's face or a race-neutral object. And they get many trials of this. And what they do is they calculate that the typical person in these experiments is faster to identify crime-related objects when they've been exposed to black faces than when they've been exposed to neutral or white faces. Now remember, these are subliminal primes. These are images that are exposed so rapidly that people have no conscious awareness that they've seen anything, let alone what it is. And nevertheless, it has activated that memory for African American in their head, which then activates the related concept of crime, which then causes them to perceive an object as crime-related faster, and to make more errors perceiving not crime-related objects as crime-related objects. There's another brilliant study in the same set of studies that shows that when people are subliminally exposed to crime-related objects, their eye gaze moves toward an African-American face on the screen as opposed to a European-American face on the screen. And there's one other little detail of this research that's particularly interesting that often gets overlooked as well, which is that the people who are subliminally exposed to white faces, or when people are subliminally exposed to white faces, they're slower to identify crime-related objects than when they see the neutral objects. So race plays a double-edged influence in this that comports pretty well with the data we're seeing on the actual lethal force outcomes. Now it won't click. Okay. Another set of studies that's highly relevant is the work by Josh Correll and his colleagues at the University of Colorado. I mentioned that the university this time. I didn't mention it last time because it's this university from down the peninsula that's obscure and nobody really needs to think about. And not Santa Clara. That's like the acceptable kind of bias, right? Cal professors are allowed to diss on Stanford. And my wife went to Stanford, so it's okay. In fact, I got my research start at Stanford, I should say. I'm very, very proud of it. So in this research from the University of Colorado in Colorado, Josh Correll and his colleagues exposed people to a series of images of black or white men who are either armed or unarmed. These are just four examples of many different stimuli, so don't try to interpret whether there's something wrong with these in particular, but generally they were developed to be very balanced. And the general finding is that people are faster to indicate a shooting response to armed blacks than to armed whites, and faster to indicate a don't shoot response to unarmed whites than unarmed blacks. And more often they will make the error of shooting the unarmed blacks than the unarmed whites, and make the error of failing to shoot the unarmed whites relative to the unarmed blacks. So this is what we call shooter bias now. And in fact, Eric Knowles and I have found, I still am doing some research in the implicit bias area, but Eric and I found that in fact an implicit association test measure of the association between blacks and weapons predicted the strength of this shooter bias. But an implicit association test, the more common one that maybe many of you have done, which is just the black-white good-bad association that is typically measured, is kind of like the cliche IAT, that measure does not predict shooter bias. And this is something that's consistent with other findings in the field, which is that it does appear to be the specific stereotype linking race with crime that drives some of these disparate outcomes, as opposed to the more generic bias. Now, that's not to say that the generic bias doesn't cause all kinds of problems in policing as well, but with regard to these particular kinds of decisions, it looks like it's that specific implicit association between blacks and crime or weapons. And in fact, Eberhardt and her colleagues carried out these studies with a sample of police officers who showed the same pattern of results with regard to identifying crime-related objects faster after being subliminally exposed to black faces as opposed to white or neutral. Correll and other researchers have shown that shooter bias is also present in samples of police officers. There's a little kernel of good news in this research, which is that in some of the police samples, they only show the bias in terms of their reaction time, how fast they shoot the different groups, and they don't show it in the error, the tendency to make more errors of shooting unarmed blacks. I'm not super consoled by that because I think that a lot of that has to do with their familiarity with shoot-don't-shoot decision-making, but it also this task doesn't simulate the real conditions under which officers are making that decision. I think under the high stress and intensity and terror that they are experiencing under a use of lethal force situation, that reaction time bias would probably translate into an error, and I think, again, the data are pretty, of the real-world data are pretty compelling on that front. And speaking of which, there is another set of studies, and you may start hearing about this research because this is sort of a counterpoint to the shooter bias research and to the Eberhardt research. This is a group of researchers out of Washington State who have been creating what is sometimes described as highly realistic video-based simulations, policing simulations, where the video responds to the behaviors of the officer. And what they found in their studies is that the officers in their sample are actually less likely to shoot the African-Americans who are the suspects in these scenarios than the European-Americans who are the suspects in the scenarios. And of course, some people are grabbing onto that and saying, see, it's actually the case that police are more likely to shoot white people. Now, of course, that doesn't comport with the real world data that I showed before, but I think they're missing the point if they see this as a counterpoint to the shooter bias studies, which show consistently that police officers are faster to shoot armed blacks than armed whites. And I think what the real lesson from this research is that under different circumstances, you're going to see different patterns of behavior. And this is another lesson from social psychology, that people's motives matter. And their ability, their capacity to control their behavior matters. In this experiment, they've got about 30 or 40 seconds to make the determination. And they see early in the scenario the suspect. So they can start to make decisions about what they want to do. They're also, their life is actually not in danger. It's a simulation. And so when it comes down to that last split second determination, they are still able to implement the control that they have evoked early in the process to say, well, that guy's black. I know what's going on these days, and I'm going to be extra careful. I'm just imposing a narrative that obviously isn't really happening. And so, but that's useful information. That means that under the right circumstances, you could see this pattern of behavior. But under the circumstances that reflect the more automatic processing that we see in the shooter task, you're more likely to see the racial bias that parallels the real world data that we're seeing. And you know, it's hard to look at these data and conclude that those simulations are accurately capturing what's going on in the real world. So I'm just going to end by saying, and I apologize for sort of ending on a note of fair specificity about this set of studies when I think the conversation we're having is much larger, but just as a take home, that Washington State procedure shows that when people are given the opportunity to control their responding, there is the potential for you to see less bias or even what people call reverse bias. The Correll procedure does not allow that, but maybe better simulates the more spontaneous responding that is going to play a bigger role in those split-second decisions once an officer has let it get to the point where they have to choose whether to use lethal force or not. Neither of these types of simulations fully captures what's really going on in a lethal force situation. But it may be the case that when police officers are given or give themselves the opportunity to control their behavior or to override their biases, that we could see better outcomes. And on that quasi-optimistic note, I will conclude and say thank you.
I was going to sit at the table, but I can't see everyone from there, so I'm up here at the podium. And I just want to say I'm so proud and pleased to be included in this conference. It's an amazing event, and it's so great to see so many people from so many communities here. So I'm going to talk about police shootings and the difficulty of imposing culpability on police in these situations where they use deadly force. And I want to look at the historical roots of police and public biases that make it so difficult, using the standards that are applied in criminal cases, to determine whether a police officer has been justified to actually result in findings that the police acted wrongly. And I begin from the premise that the state should only authorize its officers to use deadly force in situations of unambiguous and compelling danger. Unfortunately, this has, for much of history, not been true, particularly with respect to the shooting of persons of African ancestry in the United States. The very origins of modern policing in this country involved enforcing black slavery, and after the Civil War, the task of policing morphed into the enforcement of white supremacy, particularly with respect to white supremacy's material manifestations. These origins and these histories are directly tied to contemporary police shootings of African Americans and other minorities. History's fingerprints are all over the police use of deadly force in Native American communities as well as African American communities, and the per capita rate of police killings in Native American communities is almost 5 times that of white Americans. So I'm going to present some of the statistics regarding police shootings and the level of impunity which protects law enforcement, but thankfully I will not have much to do with numbers in this discussion, and we'll be talking mostly about history, which may or may not be better from whatever perspective you're bringing here. So no one knows exactly how many individuals are killed by police in the United States yearly. However, estimates range from 458 to over 1,000 individuals killed each year. For many years, the monitoring of lethal force by police was impeded by the failure of the Department of Justice to collect accurate national data on the police use of force, including the number of people killed by police. And although the Violent Crime Control and Enforcement Act of 1994 required the DOJ to collect and publish nationwide statistics on police use of force, it's failed to do so. And it's not looking promising in terms of our current attorney general with respect to future compilation of this information. But last year, several newspapers, including the Washington Post and the Guardian, published data that it collected through public records, and the media accounts and Republic reporting essentially pushed the Department of Justice and FBI to demand, and again, this was pre this administration, that law enforcement departments report virtually every time they use force. So for 2016, The Guardian reported that 1,092 people were killed by police, and of them, 892 were armed in some form, not just guns, but knives and other things that could be considered deadly weapons. And the breakdown numerically last year is as follows, with Native Americans and African Americans being most highly affected in terms of the numbers per million, because when you look at absolute numbers, the greatest number of people who are killed are white. Now, I just made a geographical note down there of the cities with the greatest numbers of fatalities. I won't go into that, though. It's kind of interesting when you look at where within different cities the fatalities occur, but that's another talk. So, the prosecution of police in these deadly force cases, both in state and federal criminal prosecutions, looking since 2005, with over 10,000 deaths estimated, and again, we have to estimate because the official numbers just aren't there, only 81 cases were prosecuted. Of those cases, 30 resulted in convictions, half by jury and half by guilty plea, with 31 cases resulting in non-conviction. And there's still some cases pending. And these notes or these numbers have been gathered by Professor Philip Stinson at Bowling Green University. Notably, 33 of these cases have been filed since 2014. So close to half of these cases did not get prosecuted in the effect of Ferguson and Black Lives Matter, I think, is pretty significant in seeing some type of response with respect to criminal prosecution in these cases. So when police use deadly force, when is it justified? Now, in the United States, because of the pervasiveness of gun ownership among the general population, officers really always have to be prepared for the worst when confronting a subject. And despite, and in light of this, most of the police, most of the fatalities by police do involve some sort of weapon on the part of the person who was shot. A legally justifiable use of force by police requires necessity and proportionality. Did the person pose a danger to the police or other people, and was the force used against that person needed to prevent the danger from occurring? So justifiable use of deadly force requires that the suspect present a threat of death or serious bodily injury to the officer or to another person. With respect to the threat of injury to the police, it has to be an immediate threat of injury. The common law approach allowed the police to use deadly force against a fleeing felon in any cases. That's been modified by Supreme Court decisions that require that when a suspect poses no immediate threat to an officer or threat to others, the possibility of escape doesn't justify the use of deadly force to prevent it. However, if there's probable cause that to believe that the suspect has committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious physical harm, deadly force may be used if necessary to prevent escape, and if, where feasible, some warning has been given. The stiffness of that last statement is because it's language from a Supreme Court decision. So, compared to other countries, the standards in the United States are pretty, wide. International law only allows police officers to use lethal force as a last resort in order to protect themselves or others from death or serious injury. It should be noticed, of course, that the United States is different from other countries in terms of the prevalence of guns owned by the citizens of the country. But there's no state or Washington, D.C., that complies with international law and standards on the use of lethal force by officers. So, in situations when, in hindsight, the use of deadly force may not have been justified, the law protects the judgment of the officer who had to make the snap on the spot decision to use deadly force. Most states apply the model penal code standard that as long as the facts known to the officer at the time of the decision to use force were objectively reasonable, then the use of force will be lawful. This objectivity standard is inherently problematic because on the one hand, everyday police force or violence, such as roughly pulling suspects' hands behind their backs, become invisible to judicial and jury scrutiny. And on the other hand, only officers who essentially knowingly violate a victim's rights, officers who are unreasonable enough to know while they're doing it that their conduct is unconstitutional and do it anyway, can be found liable. Now, police violence against African Americans is normalized because historically, it's always been standard practice to punish blacks who fail to comply with white authority, both private and public, with no regard to due process rights for blacks. The origins of legalized slavery in the United States had to overcome English common law due process protections and did so by statutory edict. Under English common law, killing even a serf was as much murder as killing a lord, even though serfs essentially had the status of slaves and could be bought and sold as chattels. But the common law protected these serfs as Englishmen, and no person on English soil could have the status of a slave. After the British colonized North America, they had to create statutory law to transform indentured workers of African origin into slaves because slavery was not recognized at common law. These statutes provided that the status of slaves followed the mother's status and granted arbitrary power over other human beings that was unprecedented in English law. For example, the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina of 1669, which were written in part by John Locke, provided that every freeman of Carolina shall have absolute power and authority over his Negro slaves of what opinion or religion soever. So colonies and then state statutes created enforcement mechanisms for maintaining slavery, imposing physical punishment on non-cooperative blacks that included whipping, dismemberment, and death. Even free blacks were subject to more severe punishment than whites, and many behaviors that were not problematic when engaged in by white people were criminalized when performed by blacks. For example, in Virginia, a slave could receive the death penalty for 68 separate offenses for which whites would receive imprisonment or not be criminally prosecuted at all. Kentucky law punished whites who committed voluntary manslaughter by imprisonment with hard labor for no less than 2 and no more than 4 years while providing the death penalty for a slave convicted of the same act. And the enforcement of these laws was made a community duty. English colonists and then colonies and then states created slave patrols to protect themselves and to protect the property that was held as slaves. The primary functions of the patrol were to apprehend runaway slaves and return them to their owners, terrorize slaves to deter escape and revolts, and to summarily discipline slaves for defiance or disobedience. The operation of these patrols imbued white citizens with the power and the duty to scrutinize and regulate the behavior of blacks at all times and places. Local law enforcement officials and the facilities of local law enforcement were used to protect slaveholders' property interest in their slaves. And at the end of the antebellum era, it became federal policy to impose a duty to enforce slavery throughout the land through the operation of the Fugitive Slave Acts. So my time is running out because, you know, history is thousands of years and I have 15 minutes. Let me just say that contemporary policing of African Americans still manifests the roots of patrolling black movements. After the mass migration of blacks to northern states and western states, one of the mechanisms that supported residential segregation was to police blacks who were in areas that were not designated as black. And so the role of police as protector of geographic racial boundaries in the current contemporary United States meant that officers who observed what's been called misplaced race, that is black faces in white areas, often assume that there's some legal deviance occurring on the part of the black residents. This assumption that legal deviance is occurring supports aggressive policing tactics that are legally tolerated as objectively reasonable responses to the possibility that a crime is occurring. Thus, police officers receive the benefit of the doubt in assessing their reactions to encounters with African Americans. And we're determining police culpability on the basis of objective perceptions when black behavior is presumed to be more deviant than similar white behavior. This ensures that police will not be held criminally accountable for excessive use of force if an objectively reasonable standard is applied. Thank you.
Everyone. Oh, I like that. So I'm going to sit for the same reason that I can't see. I forgot my glasses at home. And if my cheat sheet is any more than 8 inches away from, I'm just a mess. Don't worry about it. But we're going to make it work. So thank you for indulging me. My name is Erin Carrison. I'm an assistant professor in the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. And I'm going to share findings from an ongoing larger study that I'm working on with colleagues Jennifer Kobina at Michigan State University and Kimberly Bender at the University of Michigan Flint. And as you can see, what I'm going to talk about is the fact that your pants will not save you is somewhat of a rallying cry that we heard from a number of respondents who participated in our study in Baltimore, alluding to the idea that how you dress will not save you with respect to police surveillance and the lethal outcomes associated with that. So I'll start with Freddie Gray. Freddie Carlos Gray was born on August 16th, 1984, and he was pronounced dead on April 19th, 2015. On April 12th of 2015, Freddie Gray was arrested by Baltimore City police officers for allegedly possessing an illegal switchblade. Both eyewitness accounts as well as video footage suggests that those six officers involved in his arrest used excessive force while arresting him and detaining him, and it was also reported that the officers failed to secure him in the transport vehicle, which essentially it resulted in his sustaining lethal injuries to his larynx and spinal cord. The ongoing public outcry that unfolded following Freddie Gray's death escalated to a series of protests, riots, and even looting episodes following his funeral service on April 27th, 2015. Many, many onlookers, from all walks of life have expressed deep disappointment, concern, and frustration around those responses. But responses to the protesters, it appears, might vary with age or generational membership. Some of what folks say was the hurt and anger. The hurt and anger stemming from what they considered was a state-sanctioned lynching there's some differences in how those responses are being perceived. And they're quite mixed by age. So to give you some context, it's important to note that Baltimore City residents have not only been subjected to decades of structural violence, but that these conditions were also exacerbated by the war on drugs and broken windows policing efforts. Policing and civilian relations have been strained for many, many years and were radically transformed when the urgency for ramped up surveillance tactics outweighed concerns about due process, Fourth Amendment protections, and probable cause requirements. In addition, in the late 1980s, Baltimore PD began doing whole sweeps of neighborhoods and rounding up citizens for charges that were later found out non-existent. Under the leadership of then-Mayor Martin O'Malley, the logic was that murder rates would decline if there was no one on the streets to commit those murders. And the administration placed the bet that their unconstitutional methods and tactics could withstand federal scrutiny, because the projected crime decline would be so impressive. Ultimately, that wasn't the case. The city was sued in 2006 in district court, but the damage was already done. Pardon me. As Baltimore Police Department officers were acting as occupiers and enforcers instead of partners in facilitating public safety for Baltimore residents, that warlike mentality persisted throughout the city, which has sown immense distrust among residents, particularly those who were coming of age as millennials during that time, right? So the setting here in Baltimore for the last 30 years is rife for legal cynicism, and justifiably so, I argue, in the paper that we're working on, because younger black residents who have only known an occupied state, their home of Baltimore has always been an occupied state, and they saw their community systematically preyed upon and people being snatched up for anything and everything right before their very eyes, it's not inconceivable that they might be cynical about the legitimacy of law enforcement and the extent to which law enforcement is committed to their public safety. So regarding what black millennials perceive as an inevitable exposure to harassment or worse, one question is consistently posed. What could you have done differently, right? What should you have done differently? Where should you have been instead of the place where you were to stay safe, to stay alive, right? In addition to resisting victim-blaming perspectives at large, I find it particularly troubling that that question is often posed by other black community members, right? So younger folks are being asked, where should you have been, what should you have been doing differently by their seniors, right? This essentially is a reflection of what's called black respectability politics, which is borrowed from, it's an ideology as much as a practice, borrowed from George Massey's ideas around white hegemonic civilization, Western European class standards and mores. And it's an accomplishment that's focused on exclusivity and restraint as much as it is around a performance that's active. So by that I mean it's just as important to actively adopt these social mores and assimilate to that mainstream sort of white Western European status quo. That's just as important as making sure you don't dress a certain way or you don't consort with certain crowds and ilks, if you will, right? And the biggest takeaway that's most troubling about this is that a poor black respectability politics performance, if you will, can justify harassment from the mainstream is the argument that older folks are making, or at least it's implied when they ask younger folks, what could you have done differently? What should you have been wearing? Who should you have been with? Oh, and that's purposefully the picture of the four little girls basically tells us that the idea that dressing correctly and doing what you're supposed to do will keep you safe is actually an ahistorical claim. So for today, I'm going to share with you some findings, or a study rather, that looks at the applicability of critical race theory and legal cynicism when we're looking at these ideas and exploring these topics and the discord that ensues from them. And essentially, I'm defining critical race theory. It's the perspective that law and legal institutions basically leverage a white supremacist ideology. And legal cynicism, the way I'm operating that here in this study is that law and legal institutions and the personnel in those spaces they basically operate on a spectrum of useless to illegitimate to downright dismantling. And in particular, I'm looking at the voices of Baltimore City millennials who we interviewed 2 summers ago. And what I want to know is more about their ideas about the messages that they're getting, not just from police, but from within the Black community, their strategies for navigating those expectations of Black respectability politics, and the extent to which those politics that mandate those expectations shape their identity construction and the extent to which they engage with law or feel that they can meaningfully do so. All right. So very quickly, 2 summers ago, I went down to Baltimore right on the heels of Freddie Gray's death, and my colleagues and I interviewed about nearly 100 folks who either lived in Baltimore City at the time of Freddie Gray's death and or had participated in some sort of collective social movement, social action at that time. And that could include sit-ins and die-ins and marches, riots, looting, live tweeting, you know, allowing folks to charge their cell phones in your place of business if that's something that you were doing for folks who were out in the streets all day. All of that counted as criteria to be eligible for the study. Of the 97 folks who were interviewed, 68% of them, nearly three-fourths of the sample, identified as Black or African American. And all of them sat for interviews that were nearly an hour in length. Those were recorded and transcribed verbatim for analysis. And I'm going to focus specifically on the perspectives of the millennials who were interviewed that June. And by millennial, that's anyone who was born after 1980, coming of age during these neighborhood sweeps, during the war on drugs, the Great Recession, if you will. And I categorize them as younger, 35 or less, or older, 36 years old or more. That does not mean old. It's just I have to draw a line somewhere. I'm coming up on these numbers this summer, too, so believe me. Okay. All right, so let's get into what folks had to say when they were interviewed. So basically, everybody said that police contact is a very, very common experience, right? So these are, again, the Black millennials who I'm focusing on. It's not crazy for a squad car to be parked outside your house. It's not crazy for police to be posted outside of or inside of public schools. All of these things, police contact is not a rare occurrence. They also noted, older and younger alike, that Baltimore is not an easy city in which to police, right? So taking into account what's happening is not okay, not by any means or any stretch of the imagination, but recognizing and understanding that police are up against or responsible for policing issues that they shouldn't be policing, right? Social ills, et cetera. And one respondent said that Baltimore police officers are getting swings from every direction, right? Where there was consensus, especially between younger and older Black respondents in the study, is that lethal force is never okay, right? That you should never have an encounter with police that leads to your death. However, differentiations for explanations of why that happens or why those outcomes persist the way they do, that's that story, that testimony, tended to diverge by age. So I'll share some experts with you, because I don't have much time. But I'll tell you, I asked Black respondents across the age range to share their beliefs about Black criminality, right? So based on what you know, what you've seen in Baltimore, who you hang out with, what kind of media you're exposed to, et cetera, do you believe that Blacks are inherently criminal? You know, and I did that for folks who are Latinx, for Asian, Indigenous, biracial, international folks, you know, just moving down the line. But for now, I'm just going to focus on Black criminality this morning in that discussion. And across the board, respondents shared that they believe that in the eyes of Baltimore City cops, yes, that Black folks, particularly Black youth, are guilty until proven innocent, and that many officers believe that young Black folks, particularly men, are inherently and incorrigibly criminal. The issue, though, or the divergence, I should say, arose between younger and older respondents, where younger respondents were more likely to forgive Black residents, particularly younger ones, for committing petty, like instrumental property crimes, as well as those that were related to drug addiction. Now, let me be clear. no one was commending, you know, the commission of criminal acts by any means. But instead of naming criminality as inherent among black residents, younger respondents expressed a more empathetic understanding of sort of the larger contextual situation in which crime, particularly drug possession and sale, as well as property crimes, unfold. And so by looking at that larger socioeconomic context, they felt like that was something that lawbreaking should be attributed to, and made sure to say that over and over again. There were a number of younger respondents who talked about that. So rather than assigning individual blame for poor judgment or assigning criminality, it was more so, this is a feature of the context that gives rise to this kind of setting or this kind of behavior. So Abrianne talked specifically about this black-on-black crime that pops up all the time in discourses around black criminality. And she shared, I think that when they try to make this conversation about black-on-black crime, that's an illusion. We know our communities are segregated, and it's not uncommon for more crimes to take place among similar groups of people. Yes, statistics-wise, you're seeing stats show more crimes taking place among blacks in America, but I also think there are some economic issues at the root of that that our country doesn't really want to address, right? So younger respondents were more likely to frame criminal acts as unfolding in a context of disadvantage and desperation. I'm gonna keep moving. All right. I also wanna be clear that it's not the case that every older respondent upheld the merits of black respectability politics per se, right? That decorum and dress and that kind of comportment was what, thank you, was what you need. I don't have my glasses, I'm assuming, is that five or one? Oh, God! Okay, we can do this. I know, I need my glasses. Thank you, Chris. Where am I? Right, so while not every single older respondent, by older, that's, you know, 36 and up, upheld the merits of black respectability politics, not a single younger respondent espoused those ideas, and that distinction was stark. Instead, they said that focus needed to be devoted to the over-surveillance and unwarranted suspicion leveraged by Baltimore police officers in their spaces, right? So Jonathan is a 32-year-old who hadn't directly experienced a negative encounter with Baltimore police officers, but he was well-versed in what he believed were their expectations and did describe a code of conduct that he hoped would save him if an encounter did escalate. So he said, this is quote, if you argue with them, they might think you're being aggressive. People don't always respond the right way, and they're in the wrong sometimes. Like, what are you stopping me for? So he's mimicking other black youth who aggressively respond to police contact. That's when the police get mad. You gotta respect me because I'm the law. That's Jonathan mimicking an officer. And that's how they act. So just kind of being very patronizing about it, but understanding that this is sort of what needs to happen for you to stay alive. And he's alluding to the idea that police officers' insecurity around black people and black bodies in black spaces exacerbates their expectations of black deference. So it's not that he is surrendering so much as he's just saying, this is what you need to do, as a matter of fact sort of claim. I asked everyone also about sort of what we needed to do to move forward. What does Baltimore need? And by and large, younger and older respondents definitely said we needed regime change. Everything from Anthony Batts, the police commissioner at the time, Stephanie Rollins Blake, the governor, they just wanted to clean house for the most part. And one respondent said, we need to go back to the drawing board completely. Jerry, who's a 32-year-old, was apprehensive about suggesting a replacement for city and state government. If another election were to take place, candidates, he argued, would run the same hollow campaign platforms that, unsurprisingly to him and his millennial peers, never seemed to serve black Baltimore residents. And he offered this. A lot of times, people look at what happened and don't focus on the what and don't understand the why. But what I would say is you see a people in pain, a people who feel so disenfranchised. You see people who just feel like there's a systematic plot against them. They feel like everything, all the systems, policies, and procedures of policing, of even economic policies, even voting rights policies, they feel like these things exist to impede progress in life. The criminal justice system especially, some of the crime initiatives of the past were really kind of created to oppress, and I'm over here waiting for someone to call it like it is. Okay. I'll very quickly do the talk, and then I'm done, Chris, I promise. I'm gonna pass it over to Lynette. because this is important, right? So discussion about cynicism and what the law can do or should do, or what it should provide for black residents living in Baltimore City, that discussion unfolded in folks' homes too, right? In the living room, in the kitchen table, and what a lot of blokes refer to as having the talk with black children, socializing them to the risks or the adverse situations, contexts, and outcomes that they're disproportionately exposed to simply by wearing black skin. A lot of respondents offered mixed assessments of Toya Graham's behavior. I don't know if you all remember her. She was called Mother of the Year. She snatched up her son who was involved in the riots at the Mondawmin Mall. And for the most part, she was lauded by respondents who commented on behavior. Older respondents endorsed disciplinary action, saying, you know, kids are running ruckshot and basically someone needs to rein them in. Younger folks, millennials in this study, however, instead of praising her for disciplinary or her disciplinary action, they were more so concerned with the urgency that she felt, right? So instead of her just lashing out against her son, the understanding that she needed to do that to protect him, better it be her than an officer with a badge, was something that they were far more concerned with and troubled by. And Jermaine, who's 27, said that could have been me, and she has my respect, because a lot of parents, they won't do that. You know how many parents probably seen their kids at the mall when all of that was going on, and they didn't grab their kids like that woman did. She got a lot of props for that. I'll stop there. That's it. I gotta give it to Linda. Thank you. Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Should I turn this off? Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Linda Green, and this is a very exciting panel, and very exciting to see all of you here. Some of you have been here the whole time, and absolutely thrilled to be here to be a part of a program my classmate Eva Patterson has organized along with her fantastic team. So once I heard that she was organizing this, I said, I'm in, let's work it out. So thank you, this is fantastic. You've been hearing a number of different perspectives, and I think that is what is making this gathering so very special, because we are hearing about the problem of race from many perspectives, and we're talking about it at many levels, and that will increase the sophistication of justice-minded people as we try to change our society for the better. I wrote an article on not simply on Michael Brown, but what happened before and after, and as a prologue, I introduce some language from the Kerner Commission. And I'll quote, in 1967, Kenneth Clark, the expert witness whose research on the stigmatizing effects of racial school segregation formed a basis for the landmark Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education, also testified before the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. That was the commission convened by President Lyndon Johnson after racial unrest swept our nation's urban centers. So Kenneth Clark said this. He said there was nothing new about the causes of black unrest. Kenneth Clark said, I read that report of the 1919 riot in Chicago, and it is as if I were reading the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 35, the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 43, the report of the McCone Commission on the Watts riot. I must again, in candor, say to you, members of this commission, it is a kind of Alice in Wonderland with the same moving picture reshown over and over again. The same analysis, the same recommendations, the same inaction. The commission report summary concluded, we have provided an honest beginning. We have learned much, but we have uncovered no startling truths, no unique insights, no simple solutions. The destruction and bitterness of racial disorder, the harsh polemics of black revolt, and white repression have been seen and heard before in this country. It is time now to end the destruction and the violence, not only in the streets of the ghetto, but in the lives of people. And the point made here in my article is that we are still dealing with a broader question in our society. The shootings of unarmed black men are a part of what I've called a structure of violence. So Darren Wilson's shooting of an unarmed 19-year-old black man, Michael Brown, and we've heard this before, was the tip of an iceberg of racial subordination and despair. The deep outrage over that shooting displayed in the small town of Ferguson, Missouri, the nation, and all over the world demonstrated that the shooting of Michael Brown was more than an isolated police killing of a black teenager. The backstory involved the role of police departments and the criminal system in the lives of poor blacks, the harassment, the violence, the hypercriminalization, and the revolving door of mass incarceration, in combination with a racial and economic structure that systematically provided and provides undereducation, unemployment, and housing segregation. And so I argued that individual instances of police deadly force against unarmed black men are enabled by a legal jurisprudence of structural violence, which provides no accountability for the societal marginalization and stigmatization of young black men, as well as by a jurisprudence of actual violence, which permits police officers to decide whom to target and whom to kill with virtually no threat of criminal sanction or institutional civil liability. So I talk about the concept of structural violence. It's not my idea, two people have been absolutely pathbreaking in this discussion. Actually, a physician and an anthropologist named Paul Farmer, and also a sociologist named Johan Galtung. So they describe structural violence. It's one way of describing social arrangements that put individuals and populations in harm's way. The arrangements are structural because they are embedded in the political and economic organization of our social world, and they are violent because they cause injury to people. Neither culture nor pure individual will is at fault. Rather, historically given and often economically driven processes and forces conspire to constrain individual agency or choice. Structural violence is visited upon all those whose social status denies them access to the fruits of scientific and social progress. Human rights violations are symptoms of deeper pathologies of power and are linked intimately to the social conditions that so often determine who will suffer abuse and who will be shielded from harm. So Dr. Farmer relied upon the work of Galtung, whose essay, Violence, Peace, and Peace Research, provided a framework for understanding the dichotomies of violence and the manner in which various forms of violence stabilize injustice and simultaneously sustain volatility while therefore increasing the risk of potential direct violence in society. And so the work sets forth as a point of departure the idea that violence is present when human beings are influenced so that their actual somatic, that is the realization of their body, and their mental realizations are below their potential realizations. And this scientist talked about six dimensions of violence that contribute to the difference between the potential, our potential as human beings, and our actual enjoyment of that potential. And the point here was to explain the distinction as well as the link between indirect violence and direct violence. So we have two forms of violence, and the author made a distinction between physical and psychological violence. Under physical violence, human beings are hurt somatically to the point of killing. It's useful to distinguish further between biological violence, which reduces somatic or bodily capacity below what is possible, and physical violence as such, which increases the constraint on human movements, as when a person is imprisoned or put in chain, but also when access to transportation is unevenly distributed, keeping large segments of a population at the same place with mobility, a monopoly of the selected few. But that distinction is less important than the basic distinction between the violence that works on the body and the violence that works on the soul. Another important observation concerns the psychological injuries inflicted by threats of violence. When a person, a group, a nation is displaying the means of physical violence, whether throwing stones around or testing nuclear arms, there may not be violence in the sense that anyone is hit or hurt, but there is nevertheless the threat of physical violence and the indirect threat of mental violence that may even be characterized as some type of psychological violence that constrains human action. Indeed, this is the intention of those threats. I'll fast forward a little bit. Galtung also made a fifth distinction between violence that is intended or unintended, one important to rendering structural violence irremediable. That is, a distinction that makes structural violence the norm and places it beyond legal redress. He noted that Roman jurisprudence and Judeo-Christian ethics focus on intention, and that focus installs a bias that renders acceptable social justice. Finally, he distinguished between two levels of violence, manifest violence and latent violence. Latent violence exists when the situation is so unstable that the actual realization level easily decreases. So here, he hoped to capture the human stability, instability, and the low value on human life that is a result of structural violence, a result of these conditions. A little challenge will trigger considerable killing and atrocity under these circumstances. So latent violence indicates a situation of unstable equilibrium where the level of actual realization is not sufficiently protected against deterioration by upholding mechanisms. And this violence is also called symbolic violence. And I go on to talk about the work of sociologists who have in detail studied the circumstances that gave rise to the phenomena of Ferguson. So we know more about this, and we're making those kinds of connections in a meeting of this type. Racially explicit zoning decisions, segregated housing projects, restrictive covenants, government subsidies for white suburban developments that excluded blacks. We'll hear about that in a next panel. Denial of adequate municipal services, boundaries, spot zoning, municipal incorporation policies designed to remove African Americans from residences near white neighborhoods or prevent them from freely establishing residence. Government regulators, a government-sponsored dual labor market that made suburban housing less affordable for African Americans by preventing them from accumulating wealth. And in our current constitutional jurisprudence, we have rejected the Rehnquist Court, and now the Roberts Court continues to reject any broad constitutional obligation of racial and economic equality and render target racial measures presumptively unconstitutional. And after Brown, the court rejected the proposition that policies with disproportionate negative effects on minorities should be strictly scrutinized for their validity and necessity. And the court extended that principle of Washington versus Davis to the criminal law in McCleskey versus Kemp in the context of the death penalty. And so our constitutional doctrine immunizes from judicial inquiry the cumulative effects of private and public decision making, as well as the influence of wealth and poverty. As a result, opportunity and inclusion aspirations of minorities lack legitimacy in society. On the contrary, if our constitutional doctrine condemned or at a minimum rendered suspicious facially neutral rules with disproportionate disadvantageous effects, the gloss of meritocracy that shores up these disparities would be undermined. And so I then go on to talk about, I talked about the structural violence embedded in our society that subjects our lives to low valuation as a result of actual conditions and the stigma that comes from living under these conditions of violence. And then I talk about actual violence, and I say here that actual violence is reflected across a range, a broad range of jurisprudence, from the court's approach to the death penalty, to its approach to prison conditions, to the use of deadly force by police in the streets. Protection of a structure of actual violence is firmly entrenched in American law. So let me just close then, and in the paper I talk more about these limitations. So I close then by once again coming back to Michael Brown. Recent police killings of unarmed men, and in my paper, I make a point to make sure that all the names that I can find, that I was able to find over a period of 30 or 40 years are mentioned in the article, so that even though all the people mentioned were not the subject of protests, we should remember their names and they should be written down. Recent police killings of unarmed men: 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Ohio, 43-year-old Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York, 50-year-old Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, 19-year-old Tony Robinson in Madison, Wisconsin, 25-year-old Freddie Gray in police custody in Baltimore, Maryland, and 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in Chicago are part of a long-standing pattern. They have thrust the nation into one of its perennial rituals, the debate over whether race matters. There is no doubt that circumstances do arise in which force may be necessary to protect life, but the notion that the review of its use should be a deferential one of reasonableness flouts the irreversible results of today's weapons and rejects the understanding that death is different. When police shoot unarmed civilians with weapons that cause grievous bodily injury, police officers convert their badge to a hunting license. And this was a language from Joe Friday, Dragnet, that the police can't convert their badges into hunting licenses. Moreover, with the development of increasingly militarized police culture, trained to deploy with military SWAT tactics in communities that experience symbolic violence through structural racism, the use of deadly force against unarmed blacks is an integral part of the phenomena, including systemic hypercriminalization and mass incarceration that stigmatize entire communities and contribute to stereotypes about the inherent dangerousness of those communities. Judicially sanctioned summary execution is an integral part
of a jurisprudence of violence that shapes limited oversight of official violence in the streets, in the prisons, and the imposition of the ultimate sanction of death. Without nationwide systemic interventions, the current legal regime will permit infrequent but highly symbolic, ritualistic, and Peckinpah-like, referring to Sam Peckinpah-like killings in defense of the authority of the state to demand obedience and submission. Though death row grows elastically, now 2,635 inmates, 41% who are black, there are relatively few executions. Of course, Arkansas tried to change that. But the death penalty still plays its historical racial subordination role. I quote from Austin Surratt. Capital punishment has also been crucial in the processes of demonizing young black males and using them in the pantheon of public enemies to replace the Soviet evil empire. The death penalty is directed disproportionately not only against racial minorities, but also against those who kill white victims. State killing is thus but one part of the intense criminalization of African American populations that occurred during the 90s. Governing through crime, one law professor stated, is a way of reviving the traditional appeal of white supremacy that African Americans be governed in a distinct and degrading set of institutions. But the only public killing of blacks today takes place by police officers while the death penalty is carried out in secret. In contrast, citizen journalists and public video surveillance made the use of firearm deadly force visible, renewing the discussion of whether race matters and filling our streets with a new generation of young civil rights activists asking whether black lives matter. Thank you.
No time for questions, sorry. Just kidding. But I do want to say this. How many people are familiar with Take Space, Make Space? So people who have not had the opportunity to ask a question in the past 2 days, I would love for you all to go first. Thank you. So I knew you were coming. All right, is there anybody who has not had the opportunity to ask a question? All right. Anybody with burning questions, please come to the mic. Thank you. I'm going to do facilitator's privilege, and I'm going to ask a question first to start us off. And we're going to do this for about 5 minutes, and then we're going to break for lunch. So over the past 2 days, and really the past 32 years of my life, I've had the opportunity of trying to understand why so many people hate me because of the color of the skin of my skin and how I look. In the past 2 days, over the course of the panels, I've heard about how the darker the skin, the more likely I'm going to be subject to some kind of discrimination or abuse. One of the figures that I just saw quoted was that indigenous peoples are being murdered at, I think the rate was 10 per million. And in this panel, I've heard so much about black history and black experiences and black conditions that have shaped why this country hates me. Where are the stories or the narratives in the data and also in these kind of conversations or in the circles that you all operate in describing what's happening to indigenous peoples who are lighter skinned than a lot of African Americans and who have features that are not necessarily stereotypical African American and are suggestedly most dangerous?
Well, one of the issues is geographical situation of Native Americans, which is often outside of larger urban areas. Though I want to make it clear that there are many Native Americans who live in cities, but it's not as collective as the reservations. And when you go to reservation country, essentially Native Americans are treated as African Americans are treated. In terms of the police surveillance, in terms of the violence directed, in terms of poverty, it's actually worse there's not necessarily upper middle class in Native American communities. Prior to the development of the Indian gaming, which is changing some things, but if you actually go to these areas where Native Americans live, they're called the N-word. They're treated in much the same way. And I think it escapes the scrutiny of larger society because it's more isolated.
I'll just add, I think that's exactly right. And then there's just, from a social scientific perspective, it's sometimes just about the data and the numbers. And the numbers are smaller, and people are less likely to see them. And so the per capita number is bigger. And when you put it that way, people can see the problem. But when it's more like a handful of annual cases as opposed to hundreds, people just, it doesn't resonate in the same way. And then I think there's also the availability of videotapes that we haven't seen with the Native American cases. And that's not to say they're not there, it's just that they may not have made it into the news media.
Indigenous people are here, and we have to lift them up, and we have to make sure their stories and narratives are shared. So let's keep going.
My question is mostly for Jack, but anyone can take it. I'm curious if we know what happens when you layer gender on top of race with things like the shooter bias studies. If you have women holding the objects or women taking the tests, and of course this is a cisgendered question, I'm assuming the data doesn't get beyond cisgender, but if you could say a little bit about that, that would be great.
Sure.
Thanks.
I can try. The data doesn't get beyond cisgender, the experiments don't either, and the experiments rarely get beyond male. So there's not much to say about gender from the experiments. And if you look at the real world data, it's also the case that the overwhelming majority of victims of fatal police shootings are men. So it's hard. The numbers get very small when we try to look at that. I do think that there is, and I think the psychological research supports the notion that there is, that the stereotype of criminality is a racial one, but that it's, the intersectionality part is that it's especially potent for black men, and young black men in particular, but it's not that women are immune. And so I think you would expect to see, if the experiments were run, similar disproportions. Again, the numbers are a little too small in the actual fatalities data to make that differentiation. But and then in terms of the officers' gender, the experiments seem to indicate that female officers are just as likely to exhibit this kind of bias as male officers. There's mixed evidence on the actual use of force in the field, and it probably has more to do with not just at the individual level, but the level of representation of women within a department, and how that will affect the culture of the department and the likelihood of use of force.
As a disability rights lawyer, one of the things I was thinking about during the presentation was, I wondered if anyone has compared how white veterans with PTSD are treated by the criminal justice system versus this population. Because clearly the science is there to indicate that some of these folks we're talking about have PTSD. And disability rights law requires not just recipients of federal funds, but the government itself not to discriminate on the basis of disability. So I'm wondering, has anybody looked at that as a means of getting to this problem?
I'll say it's not my research, but a colleague of mine, Abigail Sewell, S-E-W-E-L-L, in the Department of Sociology at Emory University, is looking specifically at that, trying to measure and operationalize variables that are indicators of PTSD for black folks living in different health districts in New York. So just be on the lookout for that. It's a quick answer. Oh, also, there's veteran courts. So you asked about treatment, you know. So we have the specialized sort of problem-oriented court systems, there's no black people court, it's just criminal court. So that might be part of where we need to move to if we're taking into account, you know, sort of mitigating circumstances. That could be a way forward.
First of all, I want to commend you on your information that you provided to us, especially to me. I appreciate hearing it. I'll do some further research myself. Secondly, I'll just ask one question, and that given the report of the violence that have been perpetrated against black people, especially black men in the shooting of unarmed black men by police officers, do you think that during this day and age that we may be operating under the 1857 Dred Scott decision, in which a black man was considered 3/5 of a human being and had no rights to that a white man is bound to respect? Could I get an answer on that one?
I heard about half of it. Well, okay. Sorry, because it's like we're living in a Dred Scott era, and then...
Oh, I said... Yeah. Okay. Do you think that we are operating based upon the shooting and the taking of a human being's life without any consequences by police officers, that isn't it, or is it possible that we are living under the Dred Scott decision of 1857, which states that a black man had no rights that the white, and a white man was bound to respect and considers 3/5 of a human being? So, in other words, do they see their humanity when they take a life?
Yeah. Dred Scott addressed the issue of citizenship of African Americans, and it embodied the notion that citizenship is for white people. And that was actually the law in terms of immigration law for a very long time. The 14th Amendment included people of African origins within the legal definition of citizenship, but I think, again, there's a lot of the remnants of history in the perceptions of who is a citizen and entitled to the rights of a citizen in the United States. And therefore, all kinds of immigrants, as well as African Americans, and Native Americans who were not considered citizens per se, are all included in this kind of group of others who don't fit the historical definition of who is a citizen. Now, with the Native Americans, there's the issue of sovereignty and the idea that an important part of identity is being within a sovereign Indian nation. The pull there is really both ways. But with respect to other groups, groups other than white in the United States, there's not necessarily a presumption of actual citizenship, and then citizenship rights are certainly not accorded equally in society.
I would say yes. And that this entire conference, in my view, is about how we actually secure full citizenship. We could argue that on a most minimal level, that the right to be free from arbitrary violence would be just the floor of citizenship. We're still working on that. We are still working on voting rights, political participation, working on expanding what is redressable in courts. All of these are part of the picture. But as many have said as they've spoken, and I'll also be discussing on our next panel, that we look at our entire society and we see a racial structural violence that goes back centuries, and that we are still trying to eradicate that structural violence in various parts of society. But, you know, part of this is that the legal system does not necessarily permit redress for that lack of citizenship across the board. And certainly the project here is to try to not only expand what is redressable in courts, but also to expand political accountability so that, in fact, all of us have the right to have a responsible government that treats us as human beings and citizens, and that involves not only our interactions with law enforcement, but also our interactions throughout the society. So, I mean, that I think it's okay to say that we have a long way to go. In fact, our citizenship as African Americans really was only shorn up again in the 1960s in the second Reconstruction, and we have phenomena afoot that we are trying to understand that are making what we've known historically, our historical racism, extremely resilient and enduring. And so I think it's okay to say that we're not yet citizens, full citizens, but that, you know, through collective effort on many levels, we have that possibility.
Great. Let's thank the panelists.
This was a panel from the Resilience of Racism Conference, hosted by the Equal Justice Society. For more information, visit us on the web at equaljusticesociety.org/mindscience.